In the matter of State versus Isaiah Knight, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Ryan Keating, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Mr. Knight.
Claude Heffron, Cashman Steinbald, Medina for the ACTL.
Matthew Hanley, Assistant Prosecutor, Essex County for the State.
Deputy Attorney General William P. Cooper Dow, Deputy Attorney General of New Jersey.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Keenan, please go ahead.
You have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
May it please the court. This case is not about whether a defense attorney's office can become a repository for physical evidence of a crime accessible by the state, or circumventing a defense attorney's ethical obligation to turn over physical fruits of a crime. Ruling in favor of the defense here would do neither. This case is about the nature and purpose of the discovery process and the obligations of the defense therein. The purpose of the discovery is to prevent trial by surprise and to allow the parties to prepare legal analysis and for the trial court to present reasoned arguments to the jury based on evidence that would be presented. Our courts have repeatedly stated that discovery is not a tool for the state to build its case against the defendant. As noted in my brief, in addition to the federal courts in the District of Columbia, 38 state courts explicitly exempt materials the defendant does not intend to use at trial from the defense discovery obligation. The broad language of our court's rulings on a defense discovery obligations for almost 50 years is consistent with that limitation. Decision in favor of defense will uphold the long understood principles of discovery while protecting a defendant's rights to counsel to remain silent and to due process. The trial court's existing order is allowed to stand, and such an affidavit exists in the possession of defense counsel, the state would not only get to access to such an affidavit, but they would also be able to tell the jury that it came from the defendant in violation of those rights. Moreover, a decision in favor of defense will do nothing to inhibit the state's ability to obtain such evidence. The state can seek a subpoena to attempt to obtain such material from defense counsel in his individual capacity. The case law in the subpoena context is substantial. It provides for safeguards necessary to assure that a defendant's rights to remain silent to counsel are respected. Additionally, as noted in the Attorney General's brief, laws prohibiting obstruction of state's prosecution and the attorney's ethical obligations to provide additional means for the state to receive such materials from the defense counsel where appropriate. A decision in favor of the state will upend the fundamental understanding that every defense lawyer in the state has about their discovery obligations and sow distrust between lawyers and their clients. Building trust between defense attorney and their client is often a difficult process, especially when the client is represented by an appointed attorney they did not choose. Clients in these situations often believe that their attorneys are working with the prosecutor against their interests. Creating a rule whereby a client who receives such an affidavit would be inculpated by the act of turning it over to his attorney for the purpose of seeking legal advice would further erode that trust and violate the state and federal protections against self-incrimination. Moreover, as the ACDL notes in its brief, such a decision would chill defense counsel's investigation of their clients' cases in violation of the right to effective assistance of counsel by creating a situation where they're reluctant to receive facially exculpatory information from anonymous sources or their clients, which they could be forced to turn over to the state without protection based on allegations of criminality in their production. For these reasons, this court should reverse the trial court's discovery order.
You're done with your opening statement?
Yeah, thank you.
There's no assertion by the defendant in this case that either counsel or a defense investigator had any role in the preparation of this affidavit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's simply the state certifying that they believe a third party handed it over to defense counsel, right?
That's correct. That's just a belief. There's not based on any information.
I know you said at the outset what this case is not about, but tell us what would the obligation be if a murder weapon in a homicide case had been turned over by the defendant or a third party to counsel?
Under Rule 3.4, the defense counsel would have an obligation to turn that over. And indeed, if something like that were to be apparently handed to defense counsel, they should refuse to take it and indicate that it should be turned over. They should refuse to take it.
Slow down a bit, please.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So here we have an assertion by the state that this affidavit is tangible proof of a crime, the crime of witness tampering. Conceptually, how does that differ from a murder weapon in a homicide case that's been turned over to the defense attorney?
Well, first, the affidavit is not facially inculpatory. It's facially exculpatory. And the defense counsel would have an obligation to their client to receive such information and to investigate it and to figure out its veracity.
Right, but the request is not for anything that counsel may have done to investigate it. It's for the affidavit itself, correct?
That's correct.
So how does the affidavit itself differ from the murder weapon?
It differs in the fact that defense counsel would have to take it in the first place as opposed to the murder weapon, which they might say refuse. In either case, there is an ethical obligation tied to the fruits, the alleged fruits of the witness tampering charge. The difference is that
Why would it not be inculpatory as to the witness tampering charge?
I'm sorry?
Why would it not be inculpatory as to the witness tampering charge? I understand why it wouldn't be as to the original charge, but as to the superseding indictment for conspiracy to commit witness tampering, wouldn't it be facially inculpatory as to that?
It would be. It would back up those allegations. It would be, but defense attorneys at the time that they're receiving it wouldn't know that. So they would want to take it in and investigate it.
Can you finish answering the question that the chief asked with regard to the difference between the gun and this affidavit? I think you were getting there.
The difference being that the affidavit is only inculpatory if we believe what the individual, the other Isaiah Knight, Zay, had to say about it. On its face, it doesn't appear to be something that's inculpatory of the defendant. It appears to be exculpatory. Only when we learn, what Zay's allegations are in connection to the production of the affidavit, at that point, that calls into question, whether this is now the fruit of a crime. Defense counsel
make the same argument with regard to a gun. If someone were to present the gun that was allegedly used in the commission of a crime, you could make the same argument. The gun in and of itself has not yet been tied to the murder weapon unless further steps are taken and there's an investigation done. So couldn't you make the same argument?
Yeah, I think that in certain circumstances, like a gun would need to be investigated by defense counsel, but ultimately that would need to be turned over to the state to also do testing on it. There would need to be protections in turning the gun over to the state. There are cases out there, People v. Lee, for example, where something comes to defense counsel that's obviously inculpatory, the sneakers in that case. But in cases where there's a gray area, the state or the defense counsel shouldn't alter the item that comes into their possession in any way, but they might need to do some investigation, particularly in this case where we have this affidavit, which only becomes inculpatory based on the allegations from Zay. Defense counsel may have some pause as to turning that over at this point, or until this litigation is resolved. Trying to determine, the defense counsel.
What litigation are you referring to?
We're talking about here, in addition to...
You're talking about the prosecution of the defendant. Is that right? Under the superseding indictment that brings in the witness tampering conspiracy charge.
Not that the case is resolved, but, the question is...
You mean the outcome of this argument?
This argument, okay.
Yeah. So, ultimately, I think that would have to be turned over based on the grand jury's indictment on those charges.
Say that again. Ultimately, you believe the affidavit would have to be turned over?
Depending on I ultimately believe that, the proper way to try to get this is a subpoena. And I'm not cannot prejudge how any arguments counsel might make about that below. But in the normal case that we're talking about, something that's been declared.
up until now, has the defense suggested that a subpoena would be adequate for the disclosure of this affidavit?
Ultimately, as I said, I can't prejudge what arguments defense counsel might make in subpoena context, but that would be the right way to go about getting this item.
It does seem that you argue in your brief that either a subpoena or a search warrant would have been the proper method, but then argue that even if a subpoena or search warrant had been served, this affidavit still would be shielded from disclosure. Is that what
I didn't really come to. I can't prejudge what, you know, would transpire in that sort of context. I'm arguing that if the item was in the hands of the defendant, a search warrant would be proper. If it's in the hands of defense counsel, the way to go about that is to get a subpoena.
What does that mean? The search, you're saying that that's procedurally proper, but you are not saying that it would be, that the affidavit would be, if it exists, would be producible in response to that?
The case law seems to strongly indicate that it would be, but again, I don't know the name. There's too much that's unknown about this affidavit. I don't know what arguments defense counsel would make in opposing that in an effort to quash the subpoena, but.
Why not? You represent the defendant in this case.
I represent him on this matter, this discovery order. So
let's explore the reasons that you've advanced as to why this shouldn't be turned over. You said it would chill an investigation. How is that the case when the request is for a document that the defense had no role in creating, period?
Because as the order stands right now, the defense counsel is entirely proper in taking this item in. Whether received from defendant or whether it was received from a third party, that they should properly take this document in and investigate it in their role as counsel. If the order stands today, the state's going to be able to get up there and say, hey, we got this from defense counsel, further inculpating my client.
Isn't that something that the trial court would address at trial, of how it's characterized, if it's done through a legal process?
They could and should do that.
But what if this court were to say that can't happen?
That would be the correct thing to say as well. However, we also have the problem of this not fitting within discovery rules, and it also altering the discovery framework that we've had in the state for over 50 years, starting, you know, with cases preceding Williams, but ultimately in Williams, where this court analyzed the discovery rules in a case where the state was seeking or was able to get defense notes and photograph. And the way the court analyzed that question was it looked at the rules and it looked at the purpose of the rule.
But Williams is work product. Williams is notes that are taken by an attorney and have it, obviously almost garden variety work product that are litigated all the time as to what, you know, whether there's information there that it's not work product and so forth. But that is standard work product. This is something that as far as I can tell, nobody is even remotely indicating that that the attorney or anyone investigator on the attorney's behalf had anything to do with.
That's correct. However, in Williams, this was a defense investigator's notes of, you know, the interview with the state's witness. And according to the rule, as written, that would come in. However, the court said you can't read the rule just as it's written. The court said the state is reading that rule too literally, and you need to read in the purpose of discovery into the rule. And so in Williams, the case was decided based on the nature of the rule and the purpose of discovery, in addition to
wasn't the court simply saying the work product immunity is the umbrella over anything that might otherwise be producible under this rule? And we're not going to read the rule to say that it can be applied in a way that violates work product. But this situation, you're not contesting there's any work product at all involved here.
I'm not. And also in Williams, it wasn't strictly work products what they were concerned with. They were concerned with privileged communications as well. And that goes back through the states, through the decisions from Kosiolek, Melvins, Mingo.
It would be a very serious matter if, in fact, these allegations had something to do with the lawyer, but there's no suggestion remotely.
There's not, but it also...
It's not work product. It's not privileged. there's no role of the attorney in, as far as anything in this record indicates, that in creating this affidavit or being involved with procuring the signature of the individual on it, nothing. The attorney's role here, if at all, if any, is to have this document.
And to receive it and to be in possession of it.
Why is it in any way, going back to the original question the chief and Justice Pierre-Louis talked about, is why is it in any way different from a murder weapon or alleged murder weapon that falls into the hands of a defense lawyer?
Again, it's about the discovery rules and how the purpose of the discovery rules. And this is so far outside of what...
What is the purpose of Rule 3:13-3?
The purpose of the discovery rules is to prevent surprise at trial and to allow the parties to prepare for the evidence that will be presented. There's no intention for this thing to be presented by the defense in any way, shape, or form. So there's no need to prepare for it.
Counsel, in your brief, you make a number of important constitutional arguments that there's a potential violation of the Fifth Amendment, violation of one's right to effective assistance of counsel. And your focus this morning has largely been on a more procedural approach, that we shouldn't be relying on discovery rules here. Is that where you're placing your emphasis?
I'm placing emphasis on both. The issue has been about discovery, because this is a discovery order that's before court, and that's the question that we need to resolve, is whether this can be done through discovery. We don't have any other order before the court.
If I've understood you correctly, though, what you're saying is the court should say, discovery order is not appropriate, send it back, and we're not conceding that there's another way that's appropriate. We'll argue that at a later time.
I mean, that's what we have to deal with here. I don't have any other order before us. The state chose this path. They chose discovery as the route to do this. If they had chosen originally to go for a subpoena, the arguments might be different. I can't say.
And your Fifth and Sixth Amendment arguments, are you still pressing those?
Absolutely. The discovery order is directed at the defendant, and having the defendant turn over discovery would be a violation of his Fifth Amendment right.
So if a subpoena were served, wouldn't you be arguing that the Sixth Amendment is violated because the subpoena is being served on counsel, and that puts counsel at odds with the client, and that the Fifth Amendment may be implicated as well because of self-incrimination concerns? So wouldn't those arguments simply be rehashed in a different procedural setting?
They would be. And the protections that Your Honors have suggested would need to be implemented to obviate those concerns as to the source of where the document comes from.
I'm sorry. Can you explain what you mean by that?
The prosecution wouldn't be able to get up and say, we got this from the defendant.
But that can always be limited. I mean, there could be a stipulation as to it. The court could be instructed to limit the potential prejudice of that piece of information. So wouldn't that salvage any issues regarding effective assistance of counsel?
It could. As to, those rights, when it comes to what's presented at the trial. But the additional concern is what we're dealing with here is the discovery issue and whether this can be gotten through discovery. And the argument that I'm presenting is it cannot be, because getting this through discovery is a direct violation of the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights.
In terms of the Fifth Amendment, do you agree that the right against self-incrimination applies only to the defendant and not defense counsel?
Yes.
Okay, so you agree it cannot be asserted by any third parties?
It can be asserted if this came from the defendant and the defense counsel can assert the privilege on his behalf. But that's generally in the context of subpoena. The case law has, where that's been dealt with in Fisher, Doe, and the like cases, has been through a protective order to shield the source of the information.
So couldn't there just be a protective order in this case that says that the affidavit need only be obtained from defense counsel?
That still wouldn't, if it's done through discovery, the discovery action is against the defense. And that's why in Nevada, when they implemented a discovery rule that's similar to ours, it got struck down on Fifth Amendment grounds. And saying that it needed to contain a provision saying only materials that are intended to use at trial can be gotten through discovery. And the reasoning being is that From the Williams v. Florida reasoning is that that merely is accelerates.
Sorry, where in the rule, I see where it says defense counsel shall provide a copy of the discovery materials to the prosecuting attorney, et cetera. So where in the rule does it say this has nothing to do with the defense counsel and it's only about the defendant personally?
The rule switches back between the language of defense counsel and defendant, but the overall title is the defendant's obligations. The
correct, name on what the, if the order were tweaked to make sure that it was only applicable to defense counsel? Defense counsel must turn over this alleged recantation affidavit.
It's still the defendant's discovery obligation, which is this is based on, and the defendant's name is the one who's on the caption. This is, it's not an attorney's obligation. The wording of the order, I don't think is relevant.
Sorry, so you're saying that you agree that the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination applies only to the defendant, but because it's the defendant's case, it will always apply to anything in the case?
As to discovery, it's the defense discovery obligation. There are additional reasons why this shouldn't be done through discovery, because this will fundamentally change what we have in discovery in the state. It'll for practitioners, for defense counsel who've had this very straightforward means of knowing what they need to turn over to the state, if they don't intend to use it at the trial, it doesn't need to be turned over. This will create confusion as to what they do need to turn over. It's an affirmative obligation.
But there's nothing in the rule, you agree, that says if they intend to use it at trial, right?
That's correct, but the
argument depends on Williams and Mingo, which said that work product, anything that an agent prepares, that a defense attorney prepares, that a defense expert prepares, does not need to be turned over if they don't intend to use it at trial, correct?
Williams was not in any way limited to what was before the court. They analyzed the nature of the rule, and he said that the rule is solid because it needs to be read in context of the purpose of discovery, that it provides... The state the opportunity to see what the defense is going to present at trial. It had to be read in that context. And the Sixth Amendment question needed to be resolved because the court had to determine the nature of the error there. If you look at page 478 of the opinion through 479, they talk about the purpose of discovery, they go over the rule, and then they say the state reads the section 4 too literally, and it needs to be read in context of the purpose of the rule.
But the language which you cite in your brief, the abhorrent to our concept of criminal justice language, relates to the nexus between the notes and the defense investigation. But for the defense investigation in that case, these notes would never have existed. So the work product, the respect for work product, and the concern about work product, and as you point out, also some privilege elements to it, is woven into that decision. That's what it's about. So take work product out of Williams and take the attorney-client privilege out of Williams, and what do you have? You have a suggestion that the rule needed to be applied not precisely in accordance with this language because of the work product considerations, but why is that even relevant to your case?
Because the rule needs to be applied as to its purpose. It's not about, you know, this, and there's additional language throughout our cases saying that the state is not to build its case through defense file.
So if that is so, then all someone needs to do, a third party out there needs to do in order to shield something that's not only potentially inculpatory, but would be at the heart of that one charge for the witness tampering conspiracy, is to hand it to defense counsel, and then it can never be gotten.
Absolutely not.
So
it's a subpoena.
They can get it through. Subpoena. But then it goes in circles, because when we talk about the subpoena, the same defenses are going to be essentially the same defenses. Maybe the Fifth Amendment situation is different, but are going to be asserted. You would be back very articulately defending the decision to move to quash the subpoena.
They're going to be asserted, but as the case law indicates, the state has been very successful in getting these items in the past, and that's what the case law says. This is the proper way for the state to go about getting these things. Discovery is not the proper way about going about this.
Let me just ask. Every discovery request is served upon defense counsel in the name of the defendant, correct? Doesn't matter what it is they're seeking. So by your theory, every discovery request is subject to the same limitation.
Yes. So if every discovery request for items that are going to be used at trial merely accelerates the defense disclosure of those items. So that's why it's okay. The intent to use at trial is what makes the situation okay.
No, it's not, because the discovery request can relate to any item of evidence that may be physical evidence of the crime. And defense counsel in possession of it very well may not be intending to use it at trial because it's inculpatory. So your suggestion is that every discovery request, because it is directed to the defendant, served upon defense counsel, is now not discoverable. The gun is not discoverable.
Yes, absolutely. Any item that they don't intend, that's inculpatory, that they do not intend to use at trial, is not discoverable. That is exactly my argument.
Okay.
Can I ask you, counsel, in Rule 313.3, in terms of discovery by the state, under subsection D, it says written statements, if any, including any memoranda reporting or summarizing the oral statements made by any witnesses whom the state may call as a witness at trial. How does this not fit within that?
It does. That's exactly what Williams had. That was exactly the situation in Williams.
That was different. That was the attorney investigating and showing photographs to the witness and writing notes. And that was being prepared by the lawyer. This is something that is entirely prepared by the witness that the state is intending to call, that is now a tangible physical object that the attorney had nothing to do with the creation of, that winds up in the attorney's possession, and the state has become aware of it. How does that not fit with subsection D?
And the purpose of the rule.
It doesn't fit with the purpose of the rule because it's not going to be used at trial.
And just not to jump there yet, but what about just the actual language of this? Does it fit within that definition first?
It does, but... Okay.
And now explain why it doesn't fit within the purpose.
Okay, so it does fit within the rule, but Williams says that rule cannot be read outside the purpose of the rule. The purpose of discovery is to allow the parties to prepare for evidence that will be introduced at trial. The defense has no intent whatsoever to introduce this.
Actually, the purpose of Rule 3:13-3 is to avoid having the state confronted at trial for the first time with a written statement or statements or summaries of oral statements of its own witnesses used to attack the veracity of the witness's courtroom testimony. That's exactly why they want this affidavit.
They will never be confronted with it. The defense will not use it. They don't want to use it. So the defense witness will never, the state's witness is never going to be confronted with this.
What about the state? The state wants to perhaps call the witness and does not want to be surprised with something that through no defense investigation, not through any work product, no attorney-client privilege, happens to be in the possession of defense counsel.
They won't be confronted with it. The defense won't use it.
Counsel, you could imagine a situation where at trial the witness says something completely unexpected, and the only possible evidence that could confront that would be this affidavit.
At that point, the court rules provide for the remedy here. If the defense counsel then comes in and says, oh, I need to use that, the court can then pause the proceedings, allow the state to prepare, or they can flat out deny it. That's State v. Bradshaw.
Sorry, so if Williams and Mingo were so universally understood to mean nothing ever has to be turned over by the defendant in discovery if the defendant does not intend to use it at trial, even physical evidence of a crime, even things that have nothing to do with work product or attorney-client privilege, why would the rule have never been amended to say that? It is very common for court rules to be amended after court decisions when there is a clear understanding of the meaning of that decision. And yet these court rules, these decisions are from 1978 and 1979. You're saying they've been universally understood to mean there's no such thing as discovery unless the defendant intends to introduce it at trial. Why does the rule not say that almost 45 years later?
I think the Williams court read that in. And if you look at the GAN book, after noting the rule requires defense counsel to provide a listing of discovery materials, it goes on to state, defendant, whoever, is not required to produce by way of discovery materials he does not use to intend to use at trial. Completely unqualified. Materials, period. That's the GAN book that's used by practitioners in the state widely.
So are you suggesting this is the only time that the state has ever attempted to obtain something through discovery that the defendant did not intend to introduce that trial? This is the first time this has ever happened?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, they've tried and they've been universally rejected in doing so. With the exception of Ortega, which is...
With the exception of...
Or State v. Ortega, which is in opposite. That was a public identification procedure where the prosecutor was present. You know, defense counsel happened to be recording it, but it was recording of, you know, what the prosecutor could also testify as to what happened there. So...
But in all those other cases, was the item that the state was seeking an instrumentality of the crime for which defendant and others were being prosecuted?
No.
That's what we have here. That's why it's Mingo and Williams are completely different than the situation we have here. This is an instrumentality of a criminal act.
No, and that's why it is so in opposite of what the discovery rules call for. This is so outside of what's contemplated by discovery. This is the state trying to build its case through the defense file.
But it's not. But you say through the defense file, but it's not similar to all the other cases we've been discussing, because this is not something, using the terminology from Williams, that was uncovered by the defense, uncovered by the defense's investigation, created by the defense, created at the direction of the defense. This is not an expert report. This is not something that was created or initiated through a defense investigator or anything like that.
That's correct.
It's nothing like what Mingo and Williams was seeking to prevent the state, as you said, from, you know, basically forcing the state, the defense to help the state with their investigation and prosecution of the crime. That's really what those cases were trying to prevent. Defense counsel conducts their investigation, you know, obtains reports, gets their investigator, interview folks, and now the state can take all that information and use that in the prosecution of the defense and defense counsel's client. That's what those cases were trying to prevent. This is different here. I mean, wouldn't you agree? It's pretty different. And I still don't see a clear distinction between someone handing a defense counsel a gun, which is also an instrumentality of a crime, and this affidavit, which is the instrumentality of the witness tampering charge against defendant and others.
I agree. It's definitely different from those other cases, but there's two aspects to representation. There's the active aspect of going to investigate, sending out investigators, having your client analyzed and so forth. But there's also the passive aspect, which I didn't fully appreciate as an appellate attorney until I spoke to trial attorneys and learned how common it is for them to receive anonymous information from outside sources and from their clients' affidavits. And to be able to receive those things in and evaluate them is also an important part of representation. And to be chilled by the notion that, you know, you're taking this thing in is going to then be used against the client, it would be very damaging.
This is not and I understand that we're in a peculiar posture here because you may not know, I'm not asking, you may not know if this exists. We're assuming that nobody is saying it exists. But is there, to your knowledge, any claim whatsoever that the attorney, if it exists, if it's in the hands of your client's attorney, is there any claim whatsoever that the attorney did anything to get it?
Not to my knowledge. I have no knowledge of that.
What you're saying, I guess, is that if, and I'm saying this hypothetically because we don't know the actual facts, but if in fact what happened here is an envelope got left at the attorney's office or mailed or just appeared with no effort, no investigation by the attorney, because it went to an attorney's office, it gets the same protection as the notes in Williams.
Well, the attorney needs to be able to open that up. The attorney can't fear when they're opening up a package that's unknown from an unknown source.
I get that argument, but are you saying that because it went to an attorney's office, it assumes the same status as an attorney's memo?
It's not a work product. It might have some elements in the work product, and this decision by the attorney not to use it is a strategic decision. that they're making, but it doesn't have the same qualities of other work products. But again, it's part of the attorney's duty to do that, to accept that information in and to investigate it.
Counsel, in response to the chief's earlier question, you had said that under Rule 3.4, the defense counsel would have an obligation, an ethical obligation, to turn over or refuse to take evidence of a crime. The chief had used the example of a gun in a homicide case, but then you agreed that if there was a facially inculpatory affidavit, I think, that also that counsel would have an obligation to take that over, hand that over. So I'm not exactly sure why would it be chilled by a discovery order, but not by counsel handing it over under Rule 3.4?
I'm sorry, I think that I didn't say that, you know, if something came in that was facially inculpatory, like an affidavit, that they would have
inculpatory.
To. Inculpatory.
Facially inculpatory. Evidence of a crime.
Something that's facially inculpatory and evidence of crime, I think, are two different things.
Evidence of a crime.
Okay, evidence of a crime. They would have a duty under the rules to turn those things over.
So my question is, why just now you were talking about how that conflicts with the passive aspect of representation where they have to be able to accept everything. I understand that. They accept it, they review it. If it's evidence of a crime, they then have to turn it over. Why is that any different if it is happening through a discovery order, which is if it's evidence of a crime, you have to turn it over?
Again, the discovery is directed at the defendant, not the defense counsel. I think that distinction.
Under B, for example, it says any relevant papers which are within the possession, custody, or control of defense counsel. This could be a paper which is within the possession, custody, or control of defense counsel. So that it's only directed at defendant and not defense counsel. It says the word defense counsel a lot.
I don't think that the rules wording contemplated this sort of situation. They also talk about transcripts in possession of the defendant. The transcripts aren't going to be in, you know, possession of the defendant. So I don't think the wording of the court rule there is dispositive as to whether a discovery action is directed at defendant or defense counsel. I think that the Nevada Supreme Court's decision striking down their new discovery rule based on Fifth Amendment grounds is strongly indicative of the notion that discovery is directed at defendant. And I think that's why 38 states have this rule saying that if defense counsel doesn't intend to use it at trial, it doesn't need to be turned over.
Counsel, your point that the gun in that hypothetical that the chief provided, you were just discussing, if it has to be turned over, when does that duty arise? Is it at the moment that the attorney realizes that he's got a possible implement of the crime?
I think I haven't delved into, like, you know, I'm not representing the defense counsel here, you know, and his ethical obligations as to what he needs to do with that. that's for him to decide.
But if that duty exists, and if it arises somewhat contemporaneous with the receipt of the piece of evidence, doesn't that render the discovery order almost meaningless? It's a separate issue.
I think in this case where it might have, I don't know when it was received or whether it received at all, but you know, there were some months between when the witness spoke to the police about it and until the indictment came out. I think the indictment came out and looked at the discussion happened with the police in December, and the indictment came out in mid-March. So there are 3 months where this thing could have been delivered, and the defense attorney could have been trying to figure out what's going on with it. And then the indictment comes out. That would certainly really lend credence to the notion that it's instrumentality of a, or the fruit of a crime. But again, you know, the defense counsel is in the position of the defense counsel trying to, you know, believing their client is innocent in this and that, you know, these are fabrications. So there may be some time for the defense counsel to figure out. I don't know what they're thinking, but that counsel, would be in my position. I would try to figure that out.
Counsel, we've talked about three different courses here, and you're suggesting that the discovery order cannot apply, leaving subpoena, which you discussed with Justice Patterson, and a potential search warrant. Is a search warrant really a wise course for this court to proceed? I'd be surprised to hear the public defender
No, I didn't suggest that the defense counsel would be searched. I said the defendant, if it was in possession of the defendant, it would be proper for a search warrant for.
So under a circumstance such as this, that leaves only a subpoena.
That's correct.
I thought you were implying, at least at the beginning, I was inferring, that because the paper might have been received by counsel before the superseding indictment, you would not know that it was relevant to that crime and would have thought instead it was exculpatory. And that's why it would not be discovered.
That's why they would take it in. You know, that's why they would have.
But if it was exculpatory clue, it would be discoverable because they would intend to use it at trial to show he didn't commit the crime.
If it was what it purported to be, that it was exculpatory, and they felt that, you know, this was a good affidavit that represented the witness's beliefs, they would probably want to interview the witness who made it.
At that point, it would have been discoverable because, believing it exculpatory, it's exculpatory, defense counsel would at that point in time, in his head, want to use it at trial. And your concern is that if we chill that, he's never going to see the affidavit. He's not going to take in potentially exculpatory evidence because he'll be concerned about its disclosure.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, they don't know what it is until they read it. And, you know, they've taken it in at that point. You know, it comes in an envelope. They open it up and now they've got it.
Don't know is, you see, you admitted to us, you don't know, that when the superseding indictment was returned in April, the crime was in December. In April, at that point, he knew he had an instrumentality of the crime.
Based on Zay's allegations, there was a probable cause finding by the grand jury as to that.
So at that point, he knew it was inculpatory with respect to the superseding indictment, potentially. And that's the distinction. You don't want to chill his ability to review evidence when he doesn't know if it's an instrumentality of crime.
Yes.
At that point.
I'm sorry?
You just don't. My understanding, I think, is that you were claiming because he didn't know it was an instrumentality of the crime at the time that he received it, which we don't know if that's true. We don't know if it was the before or after the superseding indictment. At that point, he had the right to open it up, take a look at it, and not disclose it because he later discovered it was an instrumentality of the crime.
Counsel, I think we have your position. Is there anything you'd like to add at this point?
Yeah, I just also like to note that, you know, there's another affidavit that's part of this order for DJ Neptune. There's been no allegation as to any criminality surrounding if any affidavit exists for DJ Neptune. So I think that's improper part of the order. And I would just like to note that Mr. Knight has been incarcerated awaiting trial since June 16th of 2021, and he's eager to go to trial to prove his innocence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The rule that Justice Solomon just set forth is more or less exactly the rule that we are proposing in this case, which is that if a defense attorney, in the course of providing effective assistance of counsel, comes into the possession of documents that later turn out to be inculpatory, they should not have to turn over such documents in discovery unless and until they intend to use them at trial. And I'm going to try to answer some of the stickier questions that we ran into in hopes of elucidating why we think this rule is the best rule in this case. I want to underscore that these facts are rather extraordinary, because what makes this different from the gun is that when a client goes to hand a defense attorney a gun, it is quite apparently an instrumentality of a crime. Certainly not all guns have been used in crimes, but I, as somebody who doesn't have a gun permit, can't accept that gun. And as somebody who doesn't have that specific gun registered to me, cannot have that gun in my possession. So I think the gun, the narcotics, those are the easier cases. And what makes this case difficult is also what makes it extraordinary. Because at the time the defense attorney got this, And we don't know when that is, but I join in Mr. Keenan's supposition that probably the defense attorney in this case would have received this, not yet knowing the superseding indictment had been handed down.
But we have no knowledge of it. We have no information about that. We don't even know if we're spending this morning discussing it, an object that actually exists.
That's
so I don't think we can come to any conclusions. And I think the court would appreciate knowing more, but we can't pursue that.
I understand that. We don't know that. I agree. I think it's a reasonable.
Doesn't your entire position depend on knowing that? If he received it after the superseding indictment, he knows it's an instrumentality of the crime.
Right. My position does depend on that, but I think that the facts of the case make that not a fabrication of facts, but a reasonable inference. And I think the contrary is equally unlikely. There's no reason to believe.
Are you saying that the reason a gun has to be turned over or drugs have to be turned over is because the attorney, if not licensed to be carrying a gun, has no legal right to hold those in the attorney's possession?
How about a bloody knife?
I'm underscoring the fact of how obvious it is that you can't take that thing, right? Whether it's a bloody knife, whether it's a gun,
How about money? Possibly from a bank robbery. You can take money.
I think money is a complicated case as well. And I think on those facts, I think it would depend on the facts. And that's why we're in a sticky situation here, having a rather barren record. But what we do know suggest.
Potentially under your position that all somebody would need to do to keep money off the prosecutor's evidence list of exhibits is to deposit it at the friendly ATM lawyer location.
So I think that's different. That's not what I'm intending to suggest. What I'm suggesting is money could be sticky insofar as a client attempts to pay you in cash. That, I think, would present a difficult situation. However, a client coming in and saying, I just robbed a bank, can you hold on to the money? That, to me, is a clearer situation, like the bloody knife, where you can't accept that from the client. And you have to say, don't give it to me. I can't take that from you.
You need an admission from the client. This is the evidence against me. I am guilty. That's going to narrow down the number of cases.
Well, I think you need something that lets you know. I don't think that we can assume when something is not clearly an instrumentality of its crime on the face. I think we need to operate as though the lawyer is taking it in good faith to inspect it, to do follow-up investigation, to investigate it further, to try to find out what it is. And our rule says if you are doing this and you're acting in good faith and you're not taking this affidavit because you wish to keep it out of the prosecutor's hands, but because you'd like to go talk to Zay and you want to show him the affidavit or
I'm not imputing any ill will to the lawyer. I'm talking about the fact that under your rule, if something is not accompanied by an admission of guilt from client to lawyer, and is not accompanied by a label that says instrumentality of crime, this is connected with a murder on X street, then depositing it with the lawyer keeps it forever out of the hands of the state. And that is an incentive for people to use lawyers for a process that I would respectfully suggest is not conducive to the search for the truth.
I understand the concerns, and I want to restate, perhaps I wasn't clear. Our rule has to do with what should happen in a case where a defense attorney accepts something that they don't know is an instrumentality of a crime, that they don't have reason to believe. That may be an admission, there may be other facts surrounding it that give an attorney reason to believe. I mean, a knife isn't inherently, every one of us has knives in our kitchens, right? That's not a problem, but when it comes to you with blood, you have facts suggesting this is not a knife you should take. In the case of this particular document, and what makes this case, in my opinion, very difficult, is that nobody knows what the value of it is outside of further context. So I think it's highly plausible, and the inference that we're suggesting is because of the time lapse, it makes it highly plausible that this was received with no ill intent on behalf of the attorney, but the attorney's sole desire was to investigate it. And yet it can still have a chilling effect
Because if a defense attorney is going to have to prejudge everything that could come into their hands and say, will this later turn out to be troubling for my client and I will have to discover it, they won't accept documents. They won't scrutinize these things. They won't follow.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is the rule that you're suggesting then solely when it's intended to be used is the only time it can be turned over?
The rule that we're suggesting is that something that later becomes inculpatory should not have to be turned over.
Ever.
That's right.
If it's inculpatory later becomes known to the attorney to be inculpatory.
Is revealed to be inculpatory. And I recognize that there is some discomfort because of the fear of defense attorneys' offices becoming repositories. I want to underscore that I think, I don't want to say that this is not a legitimate fear, but I don't think that this is a frequent scenario. And the reasons are several. First, as we know in this case, or in the state, nearly 90% of individuals charged with crime are represented by the public defender. They are not assigned counsel until they've gone through CJP, until they've been processed. So they're not usually able to say, I just committed the crime, let me call my attorney, because they don't have one in many cases. Again, the fact that this is not obviously inculpatory makes this unique. So in many other cases and in the out-of-jurisdiction cases that the state and the Attorney General's office have cited to, it's very obvious. It is the bloody shoes, the bloody knife, something that the defense attorney should know not to accept. And in those cases, actually, a lot of times the attorney was seeking them out at the behest of the client, which is something that our rule would absolutely not encourage. So I recognize that there can be some concern.
I thought the suggestion here is that there's nothing indicating that even remotely occurred here.
Correct.
The attorney did, if it exists, the attorney did nothing to get it.
We have no idea. This could have come about, if it exists, if it's in defense attorney's hands, it could have come about because his client handed it to him, because some third party handed it to him. He could have gone to interview Zay and Zay gave it to him. We don't know what happened here. But I think
we're operating on the basis of the certification that has been presented.
Right.
So pivoting off of those facts.
Right. Well, the limited facts there in the certification are we believe, the state of New Jersey believes that defense attorney has it because that seems logical to them. Those are the facts.
That unidentified co-conspirators turned over the affidavit to defense counsel, believed. So
And I don't really know why they're unidentified at that point because they've been charged at the point that the affidavit was sworn out. I believe
Let's
they
not
were.
Quarrel with the facts. Those are the facts that we should focus on.
But I think, right, those are the facts. Those facts don't provide a basis for us to believe that any nefarious means were used to get it. And therefore, we have to encourage defense attorneys to investigate such leads. When things come into their hands that they don't believe to be, that they don't know what they are, they need to know what they are. They need to look into what those are.
Under Rule 3.4, that it only applies if it is something that is immediately, obviously inculpatory? Or do you agree that, you know, you have an obligation to take something in, you take something in, then you realize, okay, this is physical evidence of a crime. At that point, you never have an obligation to turn it over. You can just hold on to it forever.
That's our primary position because we don't...
Even under the professional rules.
Well, I don't think that the professional rule would make... The professional rule requires somebody to unlawfully obstruct. So I would say that that's not an unlawful obstruction if it's taken for the purpose of conducting investigation. I don't think you have that ill intent that's required there.
So wouldn't New Jersey then become the only jurisdiction to hold that defense counsel can withhold inculpatory physical evidence in its possession forever?
Well, I don't think we've seen any other jurisdictions who face a factual scenario like this where it comes in not clear what the content is.
I'm not sure why that matters. I understand why you're saying it's different if they know not to accept it. But if they do accept it, we're talking about an ethical obligation or a statutory obligation to turn it over, which of course only applies if they accept it. So why is it a good idea for New Jersey to be the only jurisdiction that says that you can accept evidence of a crime as long as you're not 100% sure that and as soon as you learn that it's inculpatory, you never have to turn it over?
Because of the Sixth Amendment, because of the right to counsel, because of the right to effective assistance of counsel, and because of the attorney-client relationship. Our court often has to strike a balance between the state's interest in a piece of evidence, right? That's what Fourth Amendment motions to suppress are generally about. The state usually has an interest in the evidence that's obtained and a defendant's Fourth Amendment rights in those cases, or in this case, the Sixth Amendment right. And what we're concerned about here is chilling legitimate investigations. What we're concerned about here is defense attorneys who don't want to turn over the, who don't want to look into potential investigative leads. And we believe that that's the appropriate balance. If the court is not comfortable with striking that balance between constitutional right and the state's interest in evidence, as an alternative, we have proposed, and I believe it's on page 16 of our brief, a balancing test akin to Kozlov, which offers protections under the Sixth Amendment as well, which endeavors to strike a different balance. The reason this is not our initial proposed rule is because, as Mr. Keenan said, defense attorneys need clarity. We don't really want people to stop and say, what is this going to turn up? We want attorneys to go investigate cases.
Is your alternative test the one that requires a showing of probable cause for a series of steps?
Something along those lines, probable cause, that the state's exhausted other methods of getting it or has made other attempts to get it.
So it's essentially a search warrant. But having come forward with search warrant type proofs, the state would not conduct the actual search. Is that what you're aiming at?
In a sense, but I think what we're requiring is perhaps a little different, because what we don't have here, and I think some of the questions that are milling around this case are, what did the state do to get this, right? Because if the state could have searched whatever the address in Hobson Street is, and failed to search that address where this tampering occurred for the affidavit, and their first step is to try to get defense to disclose it, that's what's troubling to us.
There's no suggestion of that at all, is there?
There's no suggestion of what they did, which is in.
And if they have one, if there is an affidavit out there and it hasn't been copied and it's in the hands of defense counsel, they could search every property in town and every car in town and never find it. So why is that even what they did or didn't do in other places even relevant to this issue?
Because I think that asking them, it's consistent with the language in TIER that the defendant has a right to the state investigating their own proofs, the defense not being part of that, to the defendant not seeing their attorney in court participating with the state, like so many people there think their defense attorneys already do.
This hinges on the state doing a whole bunch of other things, which it knows there is going to be a waste of time and resources, because they have information. I don't know if they do or they don't, but they have information. It's in the possession of the lawyer.
Well, they don't have that information here. So we're asking that they say why they think it's in possession of the lawyer and what they've done to get it and why they even need it. I think the state should have to articulate a need before.
Why they don't need on a prosecution that is based upon allegations of a witness being forced at gunpoint to recant testimony and sign an affidavit. They have to explain why that is important to that case.
I think they should have to. This case, I'm sorry.
Please finish your answer.
I can't imagine the state walking into a better case. I really can't. They have a cooperative witness, despite multiple attempts at threats, multiple things that would scare off the average witness. He continues to cooperate with them. So I think that they should have to show why they need this specific object. We can sit here and make our inferences, but I think that they should be required to make some sort of showing before a defense attorney is supposed to compromise their client-attorney relationship, which is so vital to the effective assistance of counsel throughout the entire upcoming trial, before the defense attorney has to compromise and chill future investigations. I think they should have to make a showing of need, a showing that they've looked elsewhere.
Where is that in the court rule?
Where is the balancing test in the court rule?
Well, that higher obligation you're suggesting, where there's a witness that the state is going to call at trial, the victim in this case of the witness tampering, and there's a written statement that witness is purporting to suggest exists. Where do we read that into the rule in terms of putting that extra burden on the state?
I think if you're reading this as a written statement, then you're more akin to Williams. And I understand the myriad differences between this and Williams, but you're akin to Williams and Atkins, certainly, which really articulates that the trigger is intent to use. So if you're perceiving this to be a statement that the defense doesn't intend to use, then I don't see the obligation. The balancing test that we're suggesting is if this court is to be is not inclined to go in the direction of our original rule, which we think provides the most transparent and clear and straightforward advice to attorneys, at least require something of the state before asking defense to disclose this because of the severe impact it will have.
But you're actually asking for something more than a search warrant, as it turns out. Is that fair to say? Because if the state had proof of a search warrant, they would also have to be able to demonstrate by showing a probable cause that they failed at not taking steps earlier or didn't take steps earlier to uncover what they might have.
I don't think I'm suggesting that they'd have to prove necessarily by probable cause. I don't think we took a position as to the quantum of proof or exactly how the factors would interplay in a balancing test. We would leave that to the court's sound discretion to determine the exact contours of that balancing test. But we wanted to suggest some factors that could be useful in framing such a test.
So a search warrant would not be enough?
I have my concerns about encouraging the use of a search warrant. But obviously, if a search warrant were to issue in this case, I think the defense would probably be inclined to not have their file searched through and just provide the document. I'm not saying that that isn't...
Which makes eminently good sense to me, and that's why the narrowing of the field is concerning.
And that's why... So I'm not suggesting so much that a search warrant isn't a plausible avenue, but I think as distinct from the public defender's approach that I think maybe has a more positive view of that approach, we would say as to the discovery rules avenue, were this to be provided through a discovery demand, a balancing test as to need and as to methods that have been used to try to obtain it would be more appropriate in the discovery context.
Other questions?
I just have one thing. I'm just having a little difficulty wrapping my head around something. In this particular case, as you said, they have a cooperating witness victim who has told them this is what happened, and I had to sign this affidavit at gunpoint. I have it, and these are the people that did it with me. And they figure, all right, well, the defendant and these people obviously know each other because our cooperating witness has told us that. Maybe they turned it over to counsel. And so they provided discovery request because it's inculpatory. That's the case we have in front of us. Under the rules, as the specificity of those rules, they've got more than probable cause. They've got the evidence from the victim witness as to who's involved and who likely has it. How is this not a simple old discovery, and all the burdens you're talking about have already been met?
I don't know that they'd have probable cause that it's in the possession of the defense attorney. I don't think the facts make that clear.
Okay. Based on the fact that it was defendant and his relatives,
I mean, that would be my contention, but I think what we'd want to know is Mr. Knight is charged in the conspiracy. I don't know what facts link him to this. I know the obvious inferences, but I don't know that those are facts of that he is clearly involved in this conspiracy. You can imagine.
Case before they get discovery.
I'm sorry?
They don't need to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt before they get discovery.
No, but I think, certainly not. But I think that I think that certain facts should be asserted, because what I'm concerned about seeing is a proliferation of these requests in every case, where you get into murky areas of something that a defense attorney has obtained that they're trying to investigate, that they're now required to discover that they never intended to use. And that's why what's concerning is goes beyond this case. And what's concerning is that we don't know what's coming down the pike, and we want to protect defendants.
And to do so, you're suggesting a probable cause standard be read into the discovery rule.
I'm suggesting in a case where a defense attorney did not intentionally obtain something, they are not actively functioning intentionally to safe as a depository of evidence, but they end up in the course of providing their effective representation coming into something that later becomes inculpatory, that there should not be automatic disclosure. I think automatic disclosure is really what we're arguing against here because of the chilling effect on the attorney-client relationship as well as the chilling effect on investigation. And whether you get there from our primary rule that they should not have to disclose it or from some form of a balancing test, I think on a barren record like this, we can't require auto disclosure going forward.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Henley.
Good morning, everyone. What we're dealing with in this case is a critical piece of evidence in not only a homicide, but also in a witness tampering, some very serious charges. The plain language of the discovery rule in this case requires that this piece of evidence be turned over. The plain language, which then requires us to turn to, is there any reason it should not be turned over? And as your questions indicated to Mr. Keenan, this is not a privileged document. It was not created by an attorney. It was created by a witness to a homicide. It was signed by him at gunpoint, according to his affidavit. It was not created under the direction of an attorney. It's not privileged in any way. It doesn't memorialize any communications between an attorney and his client. The production of this document, as I said, is critical to two prosecutions, and the production would serve essentially the purpose of the rules, the purpose of discovery overall, which is the search for truth. And the state is entitled to the discovery under the rules. To require the state to obtain a subpoena or a search warrant to obtain its discovery essentially renders the rules completely useless. As I said, the plain language requires the production of the document. I welcome your questions.
What's your position on what the jury can learn about if you were to obtain that document, how you acquired it?
Well, as Justice Noriega pointed out, I think that would be up to the trial judge to limit. I don't think.
What's your position when the trial judge asks you for it?
If the trial judge asked me, I don't think it would come in how the document came out. I think the issue of whether the document was produced from the defense counsel would only confuse the jury as to the role of the counsel or how it got there. I don't think that should come out at trial.
So what should happen is something along the lines of either a stipulation or an admonition to the jury not to speculate as to where the document came from.
That absolutely would be one way to deal with it. Right. So a limiting order saying the jury is not to consider where it came from. And I'm assuming there would be no testimony or no comments as to how the document came into the trial or how the document came into the possession of the state.
Questions, anyone?
Why not a subpoena?
Well, as I said, so if you require the state to get a subpoena for all evidence that's relevant and the state is entitled to under the discovery rules, it really renders the rules useless.
Well, not talking about all evidence, right? If the defendant is going to put on witnesses, if they have information about, you know, statements from other witnesses in the case, this is potentially inculpatory. Isn't that really at the heart of it? There's some other factor here. And if the state's aware of it, why not issue a subpoena for it?
Well, the state could issue a subpoena for it. But as I said, the defendant is an obligation to provide the document to provide us, right? So we don't want to get into an inquiry as to which we ask for the documents that the state is entitled to in discovery. And the defendant comes back and says, these are what we're willing to provide, and these are what we want a subpoena for, right?
What is your response to the ACDL's comment that this could become a routine request in every case?
I'm not quite sure I understood the chilling effect argument. I think that there's not a chilling effect. I think it's an unusual case factually that we have here. I don't think that there will be a chilling effect on any communication between a defendant and their attorney, because that's not what happened here. What essentially happened here was someone, we don't know who, gave, we're, we are under the logical inference that someone transported or somebody gave this document to the defense counsel, right? So if there is any chilling effect, I think the chilling effect would be defendants would be less likely to provide evidence of crimes to their defense counsel, right? Which is probably a chilling effect we want. So I don't think there is a chilling effect on any communications between defense counsel and their clients, because that's not what happened here.
But I think we're looking at it sort of in the abstract of these sort of monumental meetings where the client comes in with a piece of evidence and hands it off and doesn't say much about it, and then the attorney's left to figure it out. But instead, there's probably those moments in the, you know, Essex County Courthouse, and somebody walks into the back and the client hands through the bars a bunch of papers and says to the attorney, like, listen, I need you to look at these when you get a chance. The attorney puts them into the file, eventually looks at them and says, this is an affidavit. Like, this is from another, you know, from another witness, somebody saying something about the case. Wouldn't the attorney suddenly want to stop doing that, stop collecting information if they were afraid of a discovery demand requiring them to turn over all of those documents in every case?
Well, I see. So I see what you mean. So your chilling theory would be a defense counsel would be less willing to accept documents from a client if they're not sure what the documents are, right? Well, I think in this client, obviously this is a very strange case, but I think that the evidence we have in this case is so critical that I think that it has to be produced regardless of whether it would create such an effect. And I don't think such an effect would happen. I don't think that there are a lot of cases where defense counsel is accepting affidavits from witnesses that were secured at gunpoint. I think the factual scenario here is very unlikely to replay itself.
I understand the argument if you're saying that the affidavit is physical evidence of a crime, but I thought I saw in your brief that you're saying that it has to be turned over in discovery, even if it wasn't physical evidence of a crime.
That's true. Well, it is still a statement under the plain language of the rule. It is still a statement of a witness that the state is calling a trial. So it is still a critical statement of a critical witness.
So regardless of whether it was exculpatory or inculpatory, you believe any statement would always have to be turned over unless it was prepared by...
Correct, yes. Unless it was prepared by counsel or a counsel's investigator under Williams, then yes.
Is there any distinction between a situation where the defendant hands the, just following up on Justice Noriega's comment, hands papers to the lawyer, and a situation where somebody, some third party appears or mails a document, or there's a mysterious drop off at the office?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Is there more protection for a document, for example, provided by the defendant to counsel versus something that is mailed by a third party who does not in an attorney-client relationship with that counsel?
No. So you're playing off Mr. Noriega's, okay, handing over. I see what you mean. No, the document, again, was not created by... The relationship was not created by the attorney. It didn't have anything to do with their relationship other than the handing it over. So no, it would be the same outcome as this case.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Cooper-Dodd.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. There are two independent reasons in this case why defense counsel must disclose any purported recantation that's in his possession. And they're kind of related, but I think it's sort of important to draw this distinction here. So the first independent reason is that the recantation is not attorney work product or anything akin to attorney work product, since it was not created as part of defense counsel's preparations or investigations for trial. So it doesn't fall within the scope of the protections under Williams and Mingo and all the related cases. The second independent reason is that the recantation is itself tangible evidence, which we've discussed at length as well.
Sorry, it's tangible evidence?
It is tangible evidence of the relating to the crime, you know, particularly of conspiracy for witness tampering in this case. So that even makes, you know, as we've acknowledged, basically there are other legal statutes and ethical requirements why tangible evidence cannot be withheld by counsel in a case from the court and from the other side, that evidence, tangible evidence, needs to be disclosed. And that's also certainly within the terms of the rule. There's been a lot of discussion here today about whether an item is inculpatory or exculpatory, and whether a defense attorney may accept an item. And I suggest that the case really is not about either of those things, that it doesn't matter whether it's obviously inculpatory or obviously exculpatory or maybe ambiguous as to its effect in the trial ultimately. But the key thing there is if it's tangible evidence, it has to be turned over. It doesn't matter whether it's going to be exculpatory or inculpatory. And to the extent that this argument about this will make defense counsel sort of reluctant to open envelopes that get slid under the door or to accept papers from a client who's in jail or just coming to the office, I suppose, would be that, I mean, an easy way for them to address that problem was simply to make clear in the first meeting with a client, any tangible evidence in this case that comes into my possession, I have to disclose. I'm legally required to do it. I'm required by the rules to do it.
Doesn't that tangible evidence beg the question? Because to use Justice Pierre-Louis' example of money, and I'm not talking about counsel responded about being paid in cash. I'm not talking about paying the counsel, but the client or a third party shows up with money. So that may be tangible evidence of absolutely nothing, or it may be tangible evidence that's relevant to the case. Need more investigation to find that out. So when you say the key to the test should be tangible evidence, aren't you begging the question as to whether it's ultimately going to be found to be inculpatory or not?
Well, I'll admit that this is an unusual case in that it's possible that this recantation, assuming defense counsel got it at all, came into his possession looking more like a witness statement under the different subparagraph of the rule, and then may have been later sort of revealed to be actually maybe this is more than a witness statement, maybe this is really intangible evidence, and that your example
I think there's something about this hypothetical, perhaps existent, perhaps non-existent document we're talking about. I think that may have more certainty that this is something relevant than, for example, the generic cash that is turned over to counsel. So I think arguably you would know that this may be evidence for somebody when you see an affidavit, but when you see cash, you may not know whether it has any relationship with to the prosecution for which the client is to which the client's subject. So how can that test be a meaningful guide to lawyers?
Well, I think again that's going to the question of this question of can a defense attorney accept what's being given to them? And I don't think that's the question. I think the question is this something that has to be turned over in discovery or perhaps under statutory or ethical requirements?
So let's return to our colleague Justice Noriega's question earlier, the hypothetical about client handing over a sheaf of documents. Mm-hmm. How does the client or the attorney know what is tangible evidence when it is transferred?
Well, I think that's part of what I'm trying to say is that it doesn't matter essentially whether they know that upon the transfer, that this isn't a question of what they know when they receive it, but a question of if they later discover that that there is something in that's inculpatory, the same way that if an envelope showed up at their office and on it said alibi materials, and they said, okay, I'll stick that aside till I have time to read it. And then when they opened it, they discovered it was actually some piece of paper like here, or something that was clearly tangible evidence that was not alibi materials, but they would say, oh, well, I took it because I thought it was alibi materials, and now it turns out it's inculpatory. That doesn't save it from the requirements of production under
what
discovery.
What makes it tangible evidence in the answer that you're providing us? What is tangible evidence?
In this case, you're asking about the recantation in this case?
In general. You're defining a broader rule, and I'd like to understand its scope.
Okay. I think that what makes something tangible evidence is when that item, I'm going to kind of focus more on papers just because that seems to be where there's more room for ambiguity, but where a writing is, the value of it is in more than just the information it conveys. So the recantation here, I don't think that the state is interested in receiving this recantation for the content that's written on it. A photocopy of any recantation would not really be particularly useful. But what's useful is having this actual piece of paper in hand, which is direct evidence of the fact that, of the allegation at least, that Zay was taken and forced, compelled to write a recantation at a gunpoint. So the value is in the physical item and what it is, how it came to be, and not in simply the information being conveyed.
It sounds like you're talking about inculpatory evidence, which you were disputing earlier.
Well, but I think it would be tangible evidence, even if it were something that were exculpatory.
But doesn't that really feed into the defense's argument that, in terms of their chilling effect? Because if you're saying all tangible evidence must be turned over according to the rule, then since the burden is on the state, the defense essentially would have to sit on their hands and say, I'm not looking for anything, I'm not going to investigate anything, I'm not going to read anything, because otherwise I'll have to turn it all over.
Well, I think that what we have in these cases most often is we're looking at a lot of the investigatory processes, interviewing witnesses and retaining experts. All that stuff is protected under, because that stuff is being created as part of the investigation. I don't think that defense counsel can send an investigator out to the scene of a shooting and say, look for any shell casings and bring them back. We want to make sure that the police don't recover them. I mean, if you're sending out investigators to recover tangible evidence, I think it has to be with the understanding that if you find any tangible evidence, it's going to have to go to the court and to the state, because that's how this works. Because otherwise we would be turning defense counsel offices into repositories for incriminating. I mean, I would say all evidence, but presumably they want to disclose the exculpatory evidence.
By tangible evidence, are you choosing that term to include both inculpatory and exculpatory, knowing that most likely the exculpatory evidence is going to appear at trial? So it's really not going to be that typical case.
Well, I see which, yes. I mean, Your Honor,
I think... What does tangible mean?
I mean, I think in terms of tangible, I would say what's discussed under subparagraph B of the reciprocal discovery rule, when it talks about different materials and papers and things that are electronic, but we're not talking about witness statements. I agree there could be some ambiguity.
Sounds like it's a distinction between electronic. I'm just wondering if that's
I understand,
right,
or I'm not trying right to draw term. A distinction between evidence you can touch and evidence that's maybe more bit more ephemeral in terms of being electronic, but evidence that goes directly to the crime and is not...
Is it relevant evidence or what are
evidence?
I think it would be evidence that ties to the crime rather than to sort of investigation of the crime, like witness statements or expert reports. I mean, those are the key things I can think of that are clearly evidence and clearly relevant, but I would not say are tangible evidence because they're generated.
Are we really
later.
Talking about evidence that is not subject to the work product immunity and the potential evidence that is not subject to the work product immunity or the attorney-client privilege?
I think that often will be very closely related. I think the only thing where maybe there could be some question about it would be if, for instance, it turned out later that maybe a witness, well after the fact of a crime, had unprompted written a letter to another witness or to the defendant's mother or something, talking about what had happened. That might not be something that you could introduce at court. It would be hearsay. But maybe it could come in terms of impeachment or something. But I think there's a lot. I think that's maybe the distinction I'm trying to draw. That might arguably would not be tangible evidence if it's really just a statement. But it also wouldn't be work product because it was not created as part of or at the behest of defense investigation.
Can you respond to the test that the ACDL proffers at the end of its brief?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think that a balancing test is simply not necessary. And I think the key to that is something that this court discussed last term in Ramirez, where they said, we observe open file discovery. And there it was in the context of what the state had to produce the defendant. But this court also said, but a defense counsel has to produce similarly broad discovery to the state. And that, you know, purposes of discovery, and I'm not sure now whether this is coming from Ramirez or Williams, or maybe in both, but that one purpose of discovery is seeking out truth. That's part of it. That it's not, discovery is not strictly limited to simply preventing surprise. Certainly that's a major part of it, but that's not sort of a strict limitation on the purpose of discovery. So I think that a balancing test like that would really hinder that and would really step back from that theory of open file discovery and say, well, you can get discovery, but only if you show that you really need it. And I think that's just not how the rules are set up to function.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Quickly, Your Honor, I apologize. I think one thing I did just want to make clear, there's been the suggestion that Williams in particular created a blanket rule that defense counsel need not turn over any material that they don't plan to use at trial. And I think that's really not the case, even just looking at Williams itself. I know there are a couple of quotes sort of taken out of there, but if you really go, if you go and read Williams, that it's certainly addressing specifically work product. And in fact, not only is it, I know there's this line in there about, well, the state's trying to read this production, this subsection too broadly, and it needs to be limited by work product. But actually, Williams even points out there's a work product limitation in the rule. I mean, that's not just we're reading this too broadly, we're going to impose a constitutional limitation, though I think that's a part of it. But Williams was also saying this isn't just a constitutional limitation. There's a limitation right there in the rule that says you don't, despite what we said above, you don't have to disclose any work product. So in that way, I think Williams is not just, it's very much limited to that situation and to concerns with work product and chilling affirmative defense investigations like witness interviews and expert reports. But they are also interpreting the rule as much as they were looking at constitutional concerns.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Keenan, brief rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, just picking up where the AG left off. If the provision for work,
try to keep your voice up a little bit. Please.
If the provision preventing work product from being disclosed was dispositive of Williams, then there would be no need for the court to interpret the rule in light of the purpose of discovery. Quoting State v. Nunez, Mingo is confined to experts. The court later extended the holding in Mingo to other evidence materials that the defense does not intend to use at trial, citing Williams. Williams, we conclude that the state reads the subparagraph too literally. The purpose of the subparagraph 4 is to avoid having the state confronted at trial for the first time with written statements or summaries of oral statements of its own witnesses, which may be used to attack the veracity of the witness's courtroom testimony. Then in State v. Wiles, we have the purpose of discovery is to prevent surprise, eliminate gamesmanship, and to afford the party an opportunity to obtain evidence and search law in anticipation of evidence and testimony which the adversary will produce at trial. So this language is all consistent with the notion that discovery is only as to items the defense intends to use at trial that supports the discovery rule and the purpose thereof. In addition, as to the other aspects, this will have a real chilling effect between attorneys and their clients. Clients don't want to see their attorneys getting up there and voluntarily producing inculpatory information through the discovery process. If this is handled through a subpoena, the attorney then can be seen as fighting the subpoena through a motion to quash and fulfilling their duties to their client. Additionally, it'll create real confusion for the bar.
You could say that about anything produced in discovery. You could say that if the discovery rule requires the attorney to be seen as voluntarily turning over something, and therefore we should abrogate that rule, that would apply across the board to anything that is subject to the rule and has to be turned over.
That's not what I'm saying at all. Things that are going to be used at trial will eventually be turned over at trial. Discovery is merely accelerating that process.
Do you think a client in general, if a client's objection to having the lawyer do something without kicking and screaming and fighting it, do you think it really makes a difference that ultimately those documents are going to be produced at trial?
Well, if they're inculpatory documents, they wouldn't be produced at trial and the defendant wouldn't be turning them over.
So it's a concern about what the defendant's impression might be if there is compliance with the discovery rule and inculpatory documents are included in that?
Well, compliance with the discovery rule would presuppose that the defense is going to use them at trial as the understanding of discovery stands in Williams and so forth. So
are you saying that the defense counsel generally have interpreted the discovery rule, even though there's no language limiting it to inculpatory or documents to be produced at trial, to be limited to that?
It's not just defense counsel. Gann says that. There's no limitation on what Gann says about that. As I quoted earlier, in addition, this is an item that
is still just run into a defense counsel's independent obligation, both statutory and under the rules of professional conduct, to turn over physical evidence of a crime.
Right.
Even if the client doesn't want them to. What is the problem with during a first meeting, as the Attorney General's office suggested, between a defense counsel and a defendant saying, just so you know, if I come into possession of any physical evidence of the crime, I'm going to have to turn it over under ethical rules, under discovery rules, under the rules of professional conduct. I just want you to know that up front.
Yes, I mean, that, I'm sure the client would not look favorably upon that in that situation, but it's a different situation.
That's what you said.
I said, I don't think the client would also look favorably upon any affirmative action by the defense counsel to turn over inculpatory information. That there's no doubt about it. But if this is incorporated in the discovery rules, we'll also run into problems with defense counsel like reading that overly broad in this affirmative obligation to turn over this information. That would create quite a different perception by the client. As to the comment about the discovery process being a search for the truth, that may be true with the state's obligation in discovery, but the defendant's obligation in discovery is fundamentally different. And we have numerous cases, throughout the past 50 years saying that the prosecutor cannot use the discovery process to build its case against the defendant. That's exactly what they're trying to do here.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.